Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's
hey,
the
everybody.
Brothers
this
Wiss.
Is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 78. What is today? It's October. It's late October. It's Halloween weekend. I'm actually working on my Halloween costume. You guys want to see it?
Sure.
I always make the Halloween costumes for my kids, and I'm calling this one the Big Mouth. You see that? There's these weird magnifying panels I got from the dollar store, and
you
I made this little head
trunk.
Mount. So you slap it on, and then it makes your head look. You make your mouth look gigantic. Yeah, it's pretty bananas. I'm gonna put some lights on it. And it's Greg all the way from Texas here. Today we've got a bevy of interesting folks. What do you call a nerds? You know, it's like a murder of crows. What do you call it when you got a group of nerds? Is it a smell or an odor of nerds? I mean, like, you know, like Magic the Gathering sort of thing. I saw somebody post up a
the
picture.
Nerd herd.
It was a bar of soap and it said Magic the Lathering. Just to help those. I hear it's pretty vicious at those things. I've never been. But
dude, it does smell bad in the Magic Gatherings tournaments. I've been there.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So I'm going to start in the bottom left. That was the dulcet tones of Dave all the way from Los Angeles.
Hey, how you doing? Can I play my intro music? Can I play my intro music this
Jesus.
Week?
We always do it. 4 seconds.
You got your
seconds.
Phone ready?
Oh, yeah.
Can't touch this.
Jesus.
You can't touch this.
Yeah, you're in another 10 seconds or we get a copyright dispute.
Yeah, I know, right? So Dave says he can't touch that, but it's really... Is that just a prediction that nobody will touch you? I'm assuming that's probably more the case as opposed to...
We'll have to consult with Mr. Hammer for the answer to that question.
Above him, I've got Andrew Cox all the way from Australia.
G'day.
G'day.
That's it. No fancy intro music. I'm just here.
Way to live up to the stereotype.
All right. We've got Andrew Thrift all the way from Australia as well now, right?
Yeah, I'm in Brisbane as well, but I'm not an Aussie, so I'll say chur bro. Should say Kiwi saying, so.
It's all the same to me. You guys are all just foreigners. And apparently,
foreigners.
I just learned earlier, you're European, if you didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
The guy from New York who lives in L.A. says everybody not from America. So like all these people I visit when I go to Mexico, Europeans, they're new. below him, we've got Dave, or I'm sorry, I already said Dave. We've got Nick with us today. Nick, where do you live?
Hello.
I always forget.
I live in Illinois right now.
Right now.
Oh,
okay.
Not too exciting.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, there's Chicago's in Illinois. Are you near Chicago?
Like an hour and a half or so away. So
that
yeah,
is exciting. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, not a lot to do out here, so.
All right, let's get our vegetables out of the way. As I like to say, we have, again, man, I don't know what these guys are thinking, but they're still sponsoring us. So Sonar, Sonar.software, they're still sponsoring us. They're bananas. Scalable, comprehensive, intuitive ISP billing and operational support system. Get on that bandwagon, jump on that train. If you haven't tried them, give them a look. Like I said before, they're so popular, they have their own channel and our little brothers with Slack. So see what you can do. Go pop over there, say hi to them. Somebody's manipulating my document over here. Also, let's get this out of the way. We have some new patrons. We've got Alex Comfort, Philip Tanner, Chris Audie, and Julian Hale. So when I say patrons... You can go to patreon.com/thebrotherswift, sign up, and we have a patron-only Slack. So that thing is staying so busy, I can't keep up anymore, which is crazy awesome. And something else, I used to love to try and race everybody to answer the questions that pop in the Slack. It's impossible now. Dude, there's too many smart bastards in there.
Too many helpful folks.
I know, dude. It's great. It's great. And... nobody's yelled at me once in there, so it's fantastic. Yeah, so
you just can't tell because we don't use capitals.
You're too far away in Australia. I wouldn't hear you yelling at me anyway. But it's a great place to ask questions, pick up a lot of knowledge. We even have custom emotes. We have one called the Dave. So
yes,
whenever somebody does
please use it.
Whenever somebody does something interesting.
I don't know what you're talking about. It's just a lighthouse with a large rock next to it.
Yeah. It's more like Dave's spirit animal, I think. You know, if there was such a thing.
Getting smacked in the face with a lighthouse, yeah.
Congratulations, Dave. Your mother would be so proud. let's jump in. So I was looking at our Facebook stuff, and this is post Wispapalooza 2018, so there wasn't a whole lot in there because Mike puts all that stuff in there. So I started trolling the Slack a little bit just for additional content. I think it's interesting, you know, just the stuff that kind of comes up. And what did we find in there? Somebody was asking, I think it was you, Dave, about generating an access list based on countries. And so
yeah, that would be nice.
The Microtik config site actually has some checkboxes you can pop in there for the different countries. I haven't used it, but it looks like it's pretty cool.
Which site is this?
Dude, you've got the link. The link will be in the show notes. You can click it later.
Oh, you mean what they sent in the Slack channel? They posted that link.
Yeah, you dingus.
Yeah, but that's not that's like in some weird ass decimal format. That's like wonderful. Thank you for
No. I think it was Ollie had like CSVs you could do, but there was a different website that actually put it in Microtik firewall format already.
Wow, that's awesome. I got to recheck that because I haven't. I saw the original one that it's like in hex and SQL code.
Yeah, see in the Google Doc that we professionally use on this podcast, if you look to the right, there's a link right there. That's give that a peek. I had one in there that was a route filter for just North America a long time ago, so you can peek at that one if you want. Something I thought was funny is, Dave, you put this up. There's a Microtik Gray Hat hacker, which I think people have heard of. He's going through with the exact same exploit, and he's, I think, patching people's routers and putting firewall rules in. But in the comments for the firewall rules, he's actually asking for money, soliciting for...
You know what? My friend that this router happened to, this hack happened to, when we logged in, I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, man, you got to see this. He left us a nice note. And as a sign of appreciation and gratitude, my friend gave him $10 in Bitcoin.
Not even.
So that's kind of nice, right?
Bitcoin address. You can take that Bitcoin address and see how much he's actually been paid as well, because you can like analyze the blockchain. So we can see how much he's made.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know because I'll be jealous.
He also linked a Telegram chat in the notes, and I joined it pretty early on when I saw this coming out. There's like nearly 2,000 people in there now, mostly Russian, surprisingly.
Nice.
Like all having these big old discussions about router OS security now, and people are coming in just like, thanks man, like it's pretty interesting.
Huh. Are they using a lot of words like bro?
I don't know, bro.
That's pretty nice though, because there's a ton of people still to this day making posts about how their routers are still getting hacked into. They're not following any of the recommendations by various people on the Facebook groups, so it's nice that someone's doing the opposite and helping them out.
Yeah. A lot of people have Microtiks that they don't even know what they are. They don't know what they do. It just sits in the corner and does its thing, and until it gets hacked, they don't know about it.
Yeah,
we had a few routers of ours that we sort of missed. Like I found one or two that had it. We had to reinstall and that. But it's the fact that someone's actually gone out there and done it is. I think it's all right.
That's completely not what I would do. I would do a destination NAT rule for all their traffic to go to some like nasty porn site with donkeys and shit.
Oh, you mean your porn site? Hacker. Trying to get that revenue, get that traffic up. I get it. It makes sense. But you know, I mean, it begs the question of efficacy. Sorry, that's a hard word for me to say. How ethical is it for somebody to do that? I guess if it's out there, it's gonna get exploited anyway. Why not put a little spin on it? And that sort of that segues into something else that we had discussed was what traffic to your customers do you actually block?
Wait, before we get into that, I just want to say this is a perfect time to just say that this Gray Hat hacker deserves an award. We have to find a way to send him an award to his Bitcoin address, right? And we got to find him, send him an award. He deserves it. He earned it.
Let's get him on the podcast. He doesn't have to show his face.
Yeah. All right. So about what kind of traffic your question was again?
And so what kind of traffic do you filter to your customers, right? So theoretically, if you were an ISP and you had people that had open Winbox 8291 and you blocked that, you would have kept them from getting hit by this exploit, right? So what's ethical, what's right as far as blocking or filtering stuff to your customers? And so I know he's not here, but Tom Smith, being the most liberal guy I probably know outside of Dave here, he was basically saying that he doesn't block anything. You know, he doesn't believe in filtering anything to his customers.
But nothing.
I think he does business and residential too, right? So I know our residential customers, we block inbound. And it's really common in North America for ISPs, you know, big commercial ISPs to do it as well. We block, I think, port 80 inbound, 53 UDP, right? Because none of these, no home user needs to run a DNS server, you know, things like that. So there's,
yeah,
you know, kind of a handful of common ports that they can block. I don't think they need to be running web servers at their house that the internet's accessible to, you know, and they could run that stuff on alternate ports. That's sort of my thinking.
Why not?
What
Why
you,
the hell not?
What
well, they could pay
do?
For a business contract or something. Pay for a business account, get a public IP. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff like anything that has an amplification vector. I know a lot of people block right away because it's going to be that one person that they have a mail server or something hosted and it takes the network down. A lot of the ISPs in my area, at least, they're not super huge networks. So one amplification attack can cripple the whole network and take their service offline. So I could see how it'd be beneficial for them to do blocking. But there are a lot of people I've met at some of the conferences that think it's not the ISP's place to block. It should be net neutral. So I feel like it really depends on your bandwidth availability and if it's going to cost you business in the long run if you do have an issue.
For me, it's not even bandwidth availability. It's like if your customers can burn their own IP addresses by getting a virus or something and sending out a bunch of spam, like what do you do when the customer goes, oh, cool, I need another IP address. I need another IP address. Like, do you charge them for that? Because you're going to run out of IP addresses eventually, and some places don't unblacklist them as easily as others. Like, you have to show there's been a period of time where they haven't done anything wrong. So for us, it's like, trying to prevent that from happening in the first place because we have a limited pool of addresses and we give them out very, very sparingly. So each time someone gets themselves blocked from something, that's a big problem. Places like, we've had a few places blocked from like the PlayStation network before because people on site were hacking and things, and it's like, you can't talk to them either. Like, you try and go through the regular support and they're, oh, contact your ISP.
Yeah.
We are the ISP. That's why we're contacting you. We can't really help with that, sorry. It needs to go up to like the technical team and just never hear anything back. So if you can protect your end users from doing dumb things or like basically burning your network, then I think that that's a good idea for your own business continuity, regardless of sort of how you feel about controlling what your users see or don't see. Just protecting them that way, I think, is you'd be dumb not to do it.
Yeah, and I think every country has a lot of basic laws, you know, just, you know, like don't jaywalk and stuff like that. Wear your seatbelt. Like here in North America, you have to wear your seatbelt. You know, it's basic laws that we put in place that force you to protect yourself one way or the other.
I think it's quite different when you're serving residential customers or business customers. With residential customers, you should block UDP 53, TCP 53, UDP 123, 80, 25, all the usual stuff should probably be blocked. But for business customers, that's pretty detrimental because a lot of them do run those services. So you've either got to start dividing your customers up if you do both, or if you're residential, then just block them. No one's probably going to complain. But if you're a pure business ISP and you start doing that, you'll definitely get a lot of complaints.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it depends on the nature of the business too, right? So if they just want, say, like fiber services that are going to have an SLA attached and things like that, a lot of those guys, I mean, they're just operating a small office and they don't need all of those things either. And I've done it before, and I've worked with other people that they'll still block those same sorts of things with an open door policy to that business. If they request it, they say, hey, we're going to run a DNS server, then you absolutely open it up, right? It's just, if they don't need it, then, you know, they're not missing out on anything, and it can help protect, like, basically things like blocking port 80. You know, if you've got a cheap router that's 7 years old, that's got all of these vulnerabilities and exploits, you know, you're just sort of helping them to help yourself. Like Andrew said, what happens if more than just a single IP gets blacklisted? What if they decide to blacklist your entire subnet? You know, that could actually, and say that's all of your IP space you have, you've kind of gotten yourself boned there. And a lot of people can't afford, say, in the MDU environment, they can't afford to give a single IP to every user. So they're going to be adding whole buildings to IPs. And so you can really adversely affect, I mean, you're going to have a bad day if a whole building all of a sudden gets blocked to a specific resource because of that. So I don't know. But then, yeah, there are folks on the other end of the spectrum. And also, sometimes it's nice if somebody calls in, you could say, well, we don't filter anything. You know, so sorry, it's not my problem. And that's what we do in the data center environment. We don't filter really anything. So if they're having firewall problems, that's not us. I'm sorry.
That's not your IP ranges you're re-advertising there, though, right? It's them advertising through you?
A bit of both.
Okay. Yeah. There was an ISP here in Australia that I haven't used for a couple of years, a group called Internode. On all the residential and business services, they used to, by default, have a firewall turned on. But you could just go into your account and say, turn off the firewall. And that would, by default, would block access to your port 53, port 80, port 443, 3389. Because, of course, everyone wants to open Windows servers up to the internet. But I thought that was a really good idea, because people who didn't know any better would never go in there and touch it. And people who did know better be like, I want to host something here. Yep, okay, I'll open it up. So,
yeah. I think that's nice. Like, in my mind, if you're doing the filtering, having a very easy, quick, responsive way of removing that. Oh, absolutely. You know, instead of, like, fighting with your customer or having them, like, kind of grind uphill to get the services they require. All right. Let's see. So, moving on, somebody said, hey, it would be cool if you guys had swag, you know, stuff that we could buy, but they said your logo looks like crap. And I did not take offense to that. I whipped it together in like 10 minutes, I think, the day before we published the first podcast. So it's obviously crappy and old and out of date. So we're sort of doing a new logo challenge. If you guys have any suggestions, I can't remember who it was, but somebody posted in some pretty decent looking ones. Who was that? That was Chris Oddy. He actually posted up some
I vote we use Greg's head, just like the big You Don't Know Jack logo.
I was just like thinking that.
So basically, Greg has a boiled egg with eyeballs. I got it. Yeah.
No, a baked potato.
Because it already has eyes. I get it. Dick. Let's see. So yeah, any suggestions on that, go to Tim. As usual, this comes up every, I don't know, 6 to 8 months. Somebody said, hey, I've got an RB1100 Microtik router, and I'm using ports 11 through 13, and I'm just getting
for
really...
the X2.
Do what?
For the X2, older one, right?
Yeah, or original too, right? Original and the AHX2. Yeah, they're saying they were getting bad throughput. And I think Thrift was the one who swooped in and answered that question.
Yeah, so ports 11 to 13 use a different, I think it's a PCI Express network interface card. So every time a packet comes in, it creates an interrupt on the CPU and on the PCI bus. So it can really slow the router down. More than anything, that just pushes CPU load up. So if you can use the other ports, either the switch groups, I guess you call them, that'll definitely help. I think there's only two ports rather than three that are affected, but I can't remember which ones they are. But it would pay to look at the block diagram if you're using those routers. The worst I've seen with it, though, is people running a link aggregation group with one that's on the Switch group and one that's not on the Switch group. Mm. And they're like, oh, sometimes my sessions go slow and sometimes they're fast. And it's like trying to troubleshoot it. It's always a challenge. So, yeah.
It's interesting. So you would say use those for management or light throughput?
That's right. Yeah. Really light throughput.
All right. Fair enough. Let's see. What else did we see? Ken was trying to turn up his LTE, his WAP LTE, I think on Sprint, and he couldn't get his SIM card to register. That's what that thing is called. So he ended up downgrading to like 640.3 or something like that, and it actually came online. So I'm assuming he sent that to support, and maybe they're going to get that updated. So if your SIM card doesn't work, try lots of things. I think we've all found that to be true through various occasions.
Settle on a version for as long as you can.
There's some like inside joke here. Everybody's like snickering about something. I don't know what the fuck it is. There's something going on.
Hit and miss.
Is there something like, going on about old versions that you guys like?
Oh, man. Anyway,
the early ones used to be like, oh, the USB stopped working. okay, you can't restart that remotely. So, and then they brought in like the power down for X seconds and. But you still have these little hiccups every now and again. Like when I deploy devices with a 4G or LTE card that's connected by USB, I'll always put some sort of schedule entry in there to check if the link is up. If it's not, cycle it for like 30 seconds or something. So, because yeah, you run into these weird ones where it's like, I don't want to have to call a customer and be like, can you restart this thing again?
So, well, first you have to explain what the thing is. And then hope that they restart the right thing.
White box with a weird dongle sticking out of it. Like a what? Well, they've got the ones with wireless now, and they call them wingles. I feel like an idiot. Like, you just need to unplug the wingle? Did you just say something rude to me?
I don't know. You got to feel them out. I always figured that's how swingers approach it, right? There must be some. Like, if you're a swinger, you can't just come out and say, hey, do you want to swing with it? You know, you gotta have some kind of in. You gotta sneak in the side door. You know, it's like, do you like?
You've got a lot of experience here. Right?
No, I mean, right? It's like, think about it.
Even get there.
Think
how
about
did
it
you
in
even
your head right now. You're a swinger. You've got to approach somebody else. How do you? You know, how do you feel? It's like, do you like tapas?
Check out my dongle.
Right? Do you know? You got to think of something that's like share based. And then, hey, you into carpooling?
Hey, Greg.
What's the word?
Greg, I liked you up until that point, all right? I don't even want to know how the conversation, how that came up in your head of all shit for your brain to spit out at this conversation. That one came out.
Well, Greg's just sitting there on the side of the dance floor with his leather jacket on and his comb. Ladies.
What would I be combing, Andrew? Just curious.
I know, it's a way to attract attention.
Oh, geez. Is that like peacocking? Like,
what are you doing?
That's how they do it in Australia. They comb out the feathers. Hair. In Texas, they're like, are you a swinger? Anyway.
is that right?
I've got one in my back.
You
got
to clip that.
That needs to be a GIF. I wish Vine was still a thing.
Vine. I love Vines. I like watching old Vines.
So do
good,
my
good
children.
Vines for your Minecraft server.
All right. So let's move on. Some of the Wispapalooza stuff, I guess, is in here. I obviously didn't go because I'm not a cool kid. Although I'm almost 100% I'm going to go next year because it sounded like it was actually a pretty good time. Let's see. There was something. Was it RF Elements introduced some asymmetric horns? You guys have any opinions or thoughts on that? I didn't do a lot of research because obviously wasn't there, and so I was a little butthurt that I didn't get to go. So I was boycotting any of the information.
I've had a look at them. I think they look really good. This it looks like there's three new ones: a 30 degree, a 60 degree, and a 90 degree. I think these will just provide more spot coverage than anything else. It will allow you to, I guess, have a higher density of, say, 30 degrees that are only going to cover a particular area, and it will pick up less noise. Or you can, some people have asked if they can mount them horizontally as well. So where the where the beam would normally be kind of this wide, they can mount it that way and the beam will go out horizontally rather than vertically, say with the 30 degree sector.
Yeah,
it's 30 and 20. So yeah. I wanna shrink it down because we use them for a lot of and this may not be the intended use case for a lot of people, but we use them for a lot of point to point links because we've got some very busy sites where we're hooking up links in the middle of the city as well, and there's a lot of other 5 gigahertz stuff. So the narrower beam width I can get there, the better. And obviously, most times when you go to narrower beam width, you're talking about a huge radio, like an ultra horn or something. But if they can give me a 10 degree by 10 degree, that'd be amazing, because then you can shoot those point to point and not have to worry about all the other crap around. And like, you can get really, really busy on your masts if you've got those sort of defined radio patterns coming out.
Describe what they physically look like. I mean, they look like you took a horn and stepped on it, right?
Yeah, they're literally like you took one and just sheared the sides off or like squashed it down.
Why don't, why wouldn't you want to use something like a Siklu if you need really like really tight beam width, high gain stuff? Because I think they're like degree. Yeah, they are pretty damn expensive. What are they, like $7,000 or something?
I mean, we've standardized on sort of a mixture of Ubiquiti and MikroTik at the moment with 5 gigahertz and 60 gigahertz stuff. So for us, it makes sense to continue down that path and just improve the way we actually connect them up. So
very cool. So let's see. While they were at the show, Mike hooked up one of the new RB4011s and a CCR1009 and just did a BGP load test. And it seemed like, what was it? The 4011 was what, 50% of the load time? Something like that. And I would.
He has the video. Yeah.
It maybe have even been like a third of the load time. And you pretty much predicted that, right, Thrift?
Yeah, I did. Actually, with the business Andrew Cox works for, I was doing some BGP work there and kind of sending a large number of routes through to some of the POP sites, and I noticed the ones with the 1100AHX4, which is the same CPU. I was like, wow, these load really fast. I don't get disconnected or anything. Whereas the CCR1009s, they'd be sitting there churning away for minutes on end. So it felt like they were 2 to 3 times faster, but I couldn't really quantify it. I couldn't take BGP sessions up and down repeatedly on production sites. So I was quite glad when Mike had the time to do it.
Oh, Andrew, if it's not your network, then it's not production.
This is true.
What drives me crazy is he did that demonstration for people, and just for what it was, it's really cool. But immediately, it's the whole MikroTik single core stuff. And the mic had to jump in, and it's like every time someone tries to show it, they don't look at it for, oh, that's cool. They did a demonstration, and it did load super quick. It can only take one table, but immediately it turned into the whole single core thing. When's router OS version 7 coming out? And it's like,
yep.
Kind of ruined it, but I thought it was awesome. Nobody else is showing that kind of stuff to people.
I don't know.
I did like that. Mike linked a presentation from MikroTik from Giannis like 4 years ago now, like talking about router OS v6 and the fact that BGP would only ever be single threaded, but there was some other improvements they were going to do in router OS 7 that improved the performance of it as it exists currently substantially. So,
but
it's
I
like
think
all the go on.
Yeah, but I think, Nick, didn't you say something a while back about how pretty much every manufacturer out there, I don't know if it's every, but everyone that you knew of does single-threaded BGP anyway, so what is everybody all butthurt about?
But a lot of other vendors have a dedicated ASIC chip for it, but it's still along the same premise. It's just, that's why I kind of like
faster.
Some of the podcast format for information a little bit better, because that Facebook, as soon as you start making comments, everyone argues, and then you lose the whole point of the whole conversation. So people
sentiment.
Still probably think there's an issue with MikroTik. They don't realize it's kind of an across-the-board issue.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying MikroTik doesn't have issues, but...
I can talk about this quite a bit. So I work quite a lot with Juniper and Cisco IOS XE in that. And for a fact, they definitely run the routing process as a single process. So RPD on Junos definitely runs as one process. You can do a thing where you can effectively segment your router into virtual routers, and when you do that on Junos, then each instance has its own copy of RPD, but they're completely isolated and can't talk to each other. So no matter what your router, apart from, I think, the only one that I know of that does run it semi-multi-core are the Nokias, but all of the other ones run it as a single process on a single core. And in particular, if you compare, say, a Cisco ASR1000 versus an ASR1000X, which has a larger CPU, you'll notice the BGP performance is significantly better. Or if you compare the original Juniper RE1300s, which have a single PowerPC processor, to even an RE2000, which is slightly newer but has an Intel processor with a larger core, the BGP performance is like 2 to 4 times as fast on that, purely because of the instructions per clock on that single core. So, yeah, a lot of people are saying that Microtech needs multi-core BGP. It's kind of a fallacy. It's not really any truth to it.
Well, something to think about too is, like when you have a router doing BGP and you're pulling full tables, when is it most advantageous to have that bigger, beefier CPU? Right, it's when you're first loading the tables for the most part, right?
When it's processing the filters.
Yeah. So whenever you're initially pulling all of those routes in, everything's moving through the filters, then it's going to crunch and add that stuff to the rib, right? So, and even with normal internet churn, if you have multiple peers, you'll see in Microtech's one of the cores is usually, you know, trucking along, you know, like 80% just because of PGP, but that's normally not detrimental, right? In a stable state, it's but then, you know, when things go south, if you lose a peer or a peer flaps, then things get a little sideways on you. But that's not to say everybody doesn't have similar issues, right? I've seen that with my Cisco architecture, and I'm just now moving to iOS XR stuff, which is interesting for me because I've never touched the stuff before. But it seems like in my initial tests, like my ASR 9000s load so much faster than my old stuff. So I'm happy about it.
That's really the takeaway. So not every Cisco or Juniper pulls the feeds in the same way. You have to pick the hardware appropriately. And with Microtech, you can build it like a cloud-hosted router and put whatever core you want, and the problem just goes away.
Yeah, I think, too.
Pick the hardware for what you need.
Well, you know, you don't always have to pull full feeds. You know, if you're an average ISP in North America, what do you think? 99% of your traffic's going to be in North America? So if you really pull full North American feed and then you just get, say, at least default or subsets of international routes, you're going to cut your table down by a half or more, which means right, it's less load. Things are going to load faster, and you'll still be fine.
This actually ties in really well with the next item on the list here. I was going to talk about running this sort of thing on a CCR 1072. We don't take full tables on our upstream on our like transit links. We'll take everything from our peering services, but even then, we peer with Hurricane Electric, and they announce a ton of routes that we do very little traffic to. So when we're sort of re-announcing stuff to some of our internal devices, we'll actually filter those out because there's 60,000 odd routes that generates maybe 10 meg of traffic for us, and keeping that table size down on other routers is very advantageous to us. So like you've said, there's if you're worried about load times and you're worried about how much work you've got to do on your CCR or your RB4011, it doesn't matter which one you're running with, really. You want to be able to optimize that and optimize your routing filters so that things from your known networks are accepted first. They don't have to continue processing. Come up with a set to say, do you want to just advertise certain peering routes to internal customers and then just give them a default? Do you want to maybe only advertise bilats to some routers? Shrink that re-advertisement table size down so that the stuff that you're sending through your network, shrink it down. Same thing goes for like firewall rules and the connection table on a CCR 1072. If it's sitting as your sort of edge router there, then you shouldn't be doing that and things like that on it. And realistically, you should be doing as little queuing as possible. Try and handle that somewhere else in your network. Leave the box to do the route processing and actually spew packets out. So we've had very good success for what is very inexpensive hardware compared to the likes of Cisco and Juniper by following those principles and looking to see what we can take away from those boxes and just give them the task of processing routes. Andrew, you can probably speak a little bit more on that, having gone between us and other providers.
Yeah, so I've seen a few. Probably the biggest one I come across when I'm doing consulting is people who have got literally one CCR, usually a 1036 or a 1072, that's literally doing everything. It's terminating customers like a BNG with PPPoE. It's terminating L2TP sessions from a wholesale provider. It's doing queuing. It's doing BGP. It's doing MPLS. It's doing all these things. And they always have problems. And what I kind of do is try and tell them, look, one box to do one thing if you can. So a border router is a border router. A BNG is a BNG. Keep them separate, and that way you'll keep as many things in the fast path as possible. Because that's the key with Microtix, is you want the traffic to stay in the fast path. As soon as it goes out of the fast path, the CPU load goes up significantly and the throughput goes down significantly. But likewise, when I hear people saying they've been hit by distributed denial of services or their routers are crashing and rebooting, there's always a couple of things that it is. The common ones are that they're SNMP walking the entire MIB every time they poll their router, which is a classic one. So that causes it to poll the routing engine and can cause the routing engine on RouterOS to freeze. So PRTG is a classic for doing that. The other ones are that they have got everything running in the slow path and the CPU load's climbing up and the routers are rebooting. Just simple things like that. So, yeah.
Checking CPU load on those quickly, that's one thing that I've sort of gone to checking first all the time. It's finding if there is a single CPU core that's sitting at 100%. Now, if you're running B-test to one of those routers, it uses a single core. Yeah. If you're updating BGP, it's a single core. If you've got a queue tree, everything under the parent queue is handled by a single core. So yeah. If you have multiple queue trees or multiple simple queues, that breaks it up a lot more. But yeah, anything under one parent is handled single core again. So when that gets to 100%, everything else banks up behind that because you're waiting to send packets out. And you can actually see on a something like a 1072, you get to that point, and because that one core is bottlenecked, all the other ones go into a wait state, and it actually looks like, for a moment, you'll see all of the cores jump to 100% because they're all waiting. They're not processing anything. They're simply stuck behind that one that's slowing everything else down.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So you know, it's interesting. What we're talking about here is basic design, and so far the only company I know that actually offers a design course is Cisco. It's the CCDA and the CCDP. I took the CCDA, back in like 98. Forgot all of it.
Jesus, but, you're old.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, I really wish that Microtix would come out with a design course, because if anything, you know, Microtix can do pretty much anything you ask it to do, but like you guys said, once you start putting a little bit of load on it, it like starts falling on itself because it's not really, it's not the right way of doing things, is have one router do everything. That's kind of silly.
It's not going to do everything.
And that's the difference between, say, Cisco and Juniper.
Oh, yeah.
And Microtix. So Cisco and Juniper, if something's the wrong way to do it, they'll just disable the feature. It won't be available. Like, it's capable of it. They just won't put it there, so you can't stab yourself, kind of thing. Whereas with Microtix, it's still there. You need to really understand about where the packets are flowing through the router to get the most out of them.
What you said there is not only can you stab yourself, but you can catch yourself on fire. You can dismember yourself. You can. I mean, it's there's multiple ways.
Slowly dip your foot in the acid
on a 750G, like no problem.
I'm furiously writing notes here. When you're talking about design, good network design, I think is fairly fundamental. And when you're talking about like the CCDA and stuff like that, I think it does apply to pretty much any network, right? You can take those principles. And to be honest with you, Cisco is the best education I ever had in network stuff. And that's because I cut my teeth on Cisco. So I did all my education through there. And, you know, what do they say? The victor writes the history books. So obviously, if you're reading Cisco stuff, they invented everything. They know all the right ways of doing it.
But they do teach you the principles.
They do.
And that's something I don't see other manufacturers doing.
Well, to that end, I'm saying, why not just do the CCDA training? You know, and apply it to your network. I think you still can.
Of course.
You know, all the principles are the same. You know, TCP/IP is still the same. They still have to interoperate with the same protocols. So
that's the more important question there. Is there a Lynda course for that yet, Greg?
No, there's no design. I do have some CCMP ones. They asked me if I wanted to do the troubleshoot test, and I looked at how big the book was, and I was like, I need a break, guys. I'd been going for a year and a half straight, and I was like, I'm about to lose my mind. I was trying to figure out how to get the microtick to stab me at that point. I was trying to cut my wrists with it. I was dying.
I think with a lot of this stuff as well, you've got to be stabbed or singe your fingers a little bit to actually truly let this stuff sink in. Like, you can be told 1,000 times, but until you've experienced it.
The best way for me to learn is to learn all the ways not to do it first, and then
on someone else's network.
Well, yeah, because it's not production. Yeah. It's not production at that.
Actually, I think Nick is the only guy I know that approaches things in like a lab environment before actually trying it. Like today, I literally broke everything. Everything I have, I broke. And
who are your customers again?
Oh my god, you're a dingus, dude.
Yeah, dude, it was kind of funny. I mean, everything went down for like a minute or two or three.
Well, you're lucky it was only a minute or two or three then.
Yeah, but literally everything went down, and it's because I'm trying to do something a little bit funky. But Nick is the only guy I've seen. He's like, let's try this in a lab. Let's spin up GNS3 and set everything up.
Yeah. Well, because when you're working with things like VRRP and you're putting VLANs on top of it and things are cabled a certain way, sure, you could theoretically be like, this is how it's supposed to work, but I just like the comfort of setting it up in a lab, verifying it works.
Well,
so then I know, like, it's going to be a minimal impact on the customer.
Something of note, too, is just because you set it up a year and a half ago doesn't mean MikroTik didn't change the way you implement it now.
Interfaces.
Or, it could be anything. But something else, Andrew Cox, I've got two Andrews on here now, mentioned earlier was B-test. You know, bandwidth test. If you're doing a bandwidth test to a MikroTik, it'll usually max out one of the CPUs. So it can, if you're doing a speed test, you'll say, man, my speed is crap. I'm not getting what I expect. Well, your link, your router can probably most likely pass more traffic than it can sync. You know what I mean? So you want to do a bandwidth test through your routers, not necessarily to them, because if you max that CPU out, well, I mean, that's all it's going to be able to return. So if you're maxing it out at 50 megabits, but it can actually pass, 500 megs of traffic, well, it'd be kind of a false positive.
There's a little trick you can use there as well, where if you're actually logged into two routers, you start a B test in one direction, start another B test from the other one, you end up using two CPU cores, so you can actually then just look at the interface to see your maximum traffic in a pinch. But obviously, if you can, you want to test through the router.
Yeah, that's not always practical, obviously, but. It's something to keep in mind. Thrift earlier said something about the SNMP engine crashing MikroTiks, right? And when you think about it, anything you're doing to a router that he has to process, right? Anything going into the input chain has to hit the CPU, right? So it could theoretically affect your device, sometimes adversely. But
loading the full route table via SNMP is one of those things.
Oh yeah.
yeah. So just keep that in mind. Anything you're doing to that router itself, as opposed to moving through it, can have negative consequences. You just got to keep that in mind. Man, that was a very fruitful rabbit hole. To be honest with you,
fruitful. Yeah. So at least you didn't include swinging in that one, you freak.
Hey man, I'm done. I don't know. Why are you kink shaming me? I don't understand what's happening. I thought you were very liberal about this.
My head. That changed the way I view you now, man.
No
shit.
Have you never been approached by swingers before?
No.
It's a uniquely strange experience.
Just think about that.
Anyway. That's for another day. The two guys on the bottom went to Wispapalooza this year, right?
Am I on the bottom?
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're not looking at my screen. Yes, Nick and Dave, the non-Europeans, remember?
Yes.
You guys went to particularly interesting things you guys have to say?
I didn't go.
You're dead to me, Nick. All right, Dave, did you have anything additional Wispapalooza-wise that you wanted to add?
Jeez, nothing technical, really, but it was a blast. This year was a lot of fun. I mean, everybody we know was there. Kernak was there. He had like the smallest booth in the worst part of the whole convention, and his booth was jammed. Everybody wanted to speak to him. That was an awesome sight to see. This little guy with a good piece of software, super busy. I mean, the guy is he's definitely gonna be making a lot of money. I'm very happy for him. Baltic, of course, was there as they always are, and I was doing training with them we trained people for the MTCNA. What else? That was fun. Met a lot of really awesome people in that MTCNA class. I think that was the best class I ever trained and the best Wispapalooza I've ever been to. Really amazing stuff. I even won some $150 Bose headsets, which I couldn't give a shit about because I don't listen to music, but they make great headphones for your phone. Honestly, it was a really great time. It didn't even feel like work. Even training didn't feel like work. It was that much fun.
You know what I was thinking is I want to go to Wispapalooza, but I don't want to do anything technical there. I just want to hang out with people. And I was thinking, doesn't that make it just a vacation at that point?
Yeah, it's a business vacation. I've always wanted to go to
Wispapalooza. I've only been to Wispamericas. So
that's tiny.
I'm not a big Vegas guy, but everybody goes to that, so there's just more people. So that's why I like it better.
I'll tell you what, if you guys ever want to go, we'll all split a room, all right? We're all fucking cramming to one little place, and
that was an
you can tell me
pause
about
after you said fucking there, Dave. Yeah, that made me nervous.
No, I'm thinking you could tell us about your swinging little adventures that you've been in approached for, because it is expensive getting out there. It really is expensive getting out to Wispapalooza. I mean, I was lucky I got to drive there because I only live 4 hours away in L.A., and my wife's nephew goes to UNLV, so I was sleeping in his freaking dorm to save money. Literally, the whole thing just cost me food.
Did you go to any dorm parties, though? That's the...
You know, I was so disappointed. That was the most disappointing part of this whole vacation thing because he's on the hockey team. Get this. And you think hockey players are nuts. I mean, we all saw Slapshot, right?
They're all Canadians, right?
And it was nothing like that. They were so respectful, so quiet.
Yeah, Canadians.
I came out and I'm like, guys, what the fuck? And they're like, what? And I'm like, why is it so quiet? I was like, you guys should be partying, playing music, breaking shit, having girls crying, running out of the dorm, and all the things that you do in a dorm. You know, there's always a crying girl in a dorm, by the way. But yeah, always someone pissed off. My boyfriend is cheating on me. Something like that. You guys, what the fuck? You guys never lived? Seriously?
I didn't go to a real college. I went to a technical college. So it's like high school version 2 is really what it was for me.
All right. So look, when we go to the next Wispapalooza, we'll rent a place and we'll do stupid shit. It'll be like a college reunion. All right. You'll wake up getting smacked in the face with an award.
Oh, boy.
Oh, you're really selling this, Dave.
So you're definitely smuggling
just
something into the room.
Some mansion.
You know what I did miss
I'll pay a hooker to sleep right next to you in your bed without letting you know, and then you'll wake up next to like Shaniqua or something.
I'm fairly certain it's not going to happen. What I was going to say is what I missed was Adam Bell took us to like a 24-hour Korean barbecue joint last time, and it was I think it was like 2 a.m. and it was amazing. It was crazy good.
Wow, you are so old. How the fuck do you talk about going to a place like Vegas? And I'm not talking about like the crazy shit that happens in Vegas and talk about Korean barbecue. Yeah, food is great, but you could have great food in your neighborhood.
No, Korean I can't, dude. Not everybody lives in LA. That's like this huge melting pot of culture. And
dude, we're going to go to Wispapalooza. We're going to have a stupid great time. It's going to be fun.
And then you could talk about your stupid barbecue. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm sure it's great barbecue. Everybody loves barbecue, you Texan. But
no, Korean we're gonna barbecue, you ding dong.
Whatever.
It is like night and day.
Yes, I know. I live in LA. There's a lot of Korean barbecue here. And by the way, I don't eat mammals, so I would not know how good it is.
Well, see, that's why you're anyway. Tangent over. We've got a vegan, folks. Use
not a vegan. I'm not a vegan.
You're as good
actually,
as vegan to me.
Two vegans, by the way. But anyway.
You're two vegans?
Or
you've eaten two vegans?
How else do you absorb their power? You know, it's sort of like.
Greg has insert both feet in his mouth.
It's like Highlander rules, but you actually have to eat them afterwards. So it's a bit messier.
So, Greg's going to wake up with Shaniqua. You're going to wake up with like a mouthful of sausage.
Ah, a mouthful of sausage. See? That's what I said before we started recording. You always have a picture
you
of you
a
with
mouthful
smart
of sausage
on
yeah.
Facebook.
All right. Good times. All right. Moving on.
Yes.
So I'm pretty sure this happened post the last podcast, but Bloomberg put out a big report about Supermicro and how Chinese spies were inserting chips, and those were getting shipped to like the federal government over here in the United States. And I think they said Apple and Amazon were getting these servers, which it was just scandalous, right? The
it's
idea
a fairy
of this.
Tale.
And the first thing that happened when I post that in the Slack was Steve Gilbert, I think, said, "This doesn't seem like it's vetted very well." He's like, where are their sources? What is blah, blah, blah? And there's been a lot of pushback. I mean, it wasn't like, because usually, you know, if a company is hacked, they're very cautious and careful about the way they respond. But the big boys just instantly were like, we have no idea what they're talking about. This did not happen, right? It's just very staunch. And the more and more people start looking at this, the more, I guess, conflated the claims seem to be, you know, the little edge, because, you know, when you start looking at all the various evidence, it does seem pretty outrageous. What do you guys, have you guys been keeping up with that or?
Yeah, I have been. I've been following it quite closely. So there's a website called servethehome.com, which is written by, maintained by a guy, I think his name's Patrick Kennedy. He's got a lot of good information on it. Dave, you're throwing me there, mate. he's got a lot of good information on it, but the thing that kind of struck me is, why would you go to all the effort of getting into the supply chain and smuggling this little chip in there and having to manipulate Supermicro's internal stuff when you could just write a custom firmware for the A-Speed baseboard management controller and have full access to everything without ever having to touch the board or do anything? And then you'd also have access to Dell and Hewlett-Packard's ILO, because they all use the same A-Speed chipset for the baseboard management controller. So it all just seems very far-fetched to me. It's a whole lot of half-truths in the article. Like, there's not much real truth to it, in my opinion.
You know what really perplexed me about the whole thing was the idea that they're going to put a piece of hardware in there, right, that's going to phone home in some form or fashion, right? I mean, that would be the whole point, is that it could reach out and exfiltrate information, or maybe pull up revisions of what they want it to do, you know, so whatever. It has to phone home in some way. And so the only way it's going to be able to do that is with the onboard networking. And from talking to some people that are extremely sensitive about their information, like they have, you know, all kinds of alerts for anything network traffic wise that's anomalous. You know, it just immediately starts up setting off bells and whistles. So this thing's going to have to phone home. So isn't that going to get caught in these very sensitive areas? So it just seemed like I just couldn't wrap my mind around how this would be beneficial for these people.
So the BMC usually has a dedicated network that it runs on. So you could scan that. But the thing is, with the BMC, it can also run on the onboard NICs. So if the onboard NICs are on an untrusted network that's, say, responding to web requests, if you're like Facebook or something like that, it could potentially go out there and be less likely to be detected. But I think most intrusion detection systems would eventually pick it up that there was some sort of odd traffic being generated from an IP address.
Well, if you think of it, remember the Microtik hacks. One of the things that they did was they proxied
traffic, TCP traffic through MikroTik routers. I caught a few that were doing that, and I guess, yeah, maybe it doesn't have to phone home to China. Maybe it could phone to something here in America that's very non-noticeable.
Yeah, what?
Yeah, it could be a DNS request that looks completely normal, but if the Chinese are managing that server.
Well, it could be like... Like, I know some guys that work in an environment that's so secure that they have, like, database servers that are only allowed to communicate to very specific destination hosts. So if anything ever goes to any other IP space.
I saw that in a TV show.
No.
Come on. What was it?
Well, I mean, I actually know and talked to a guy, and they had a breach of some sort, and that's how they picked – that was their first indication, is that all of a sudden – these core database servers started trying to communicate out to places they weren't supposed to be able to. And so they like quite literally pulled the plug on all that stuff to cut it off. And then once they started walking back the cat, they found out how these guys had infiltrated, you know, at first their communications and then got into like their Gmail and then kind of went
sounds
across.
Exactly.
So it's crazy that server was what actually tipped them off. So think about it. If you have a server in a very critical environment that's being monitored that sharply, you're not going to get away with something like that.
Mr. Robot Season 1. Exactly that scenario.
Well, I've never watched Mr. Robot. But
you got to watch it.
You've met this guy in real life, I think. I don't want to name names on that stuff.
As well.
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about.
The thing that gets me is, so everyone's coming out and gone, this is patently untrue, like, what they've put in the article couldn't be the case, but regardless of whether this did happen to Apple or Amazon or the Department of Defense, it entirely is possible to do something like this. And like, people sort of forget every now and again, like, that it's the U.S. does the same sort of things. Oh, like, we learned anything from the WikiLeaks publications and things, like intercepting hardware, putting custom firmware on it, or replacing certain cards and things, like, is entirely within the realm of what sort of nation state espionage entails. All these things are possible. All these can happen, and they probably are happening. And we the lay people just don't hear about it for the most part, because you're not going to publicize the fact that you've seen something like that. So I 100%, while the story that they've told may be fabricated, maybe they picked AWS and Amazon just to be like, here's some examples of big companies that may have had this happen, even though they didn't. It's the underlying hacks that are happening do exist and have been seen in the wild before. They actually published it wasn't so much a follow-up article as like talking about other hacked Supermicro hardware and stuff, and talking about some of the Ethernet jacks in previous hacks that they'd seen replaced. So where like they detected these ones because the Ethernet shroud was replaced with a metal one rather than a plastic one, and they're like, well, it's dissipating more heat, there's something else in there, and we've seen these sort of things in the wild before. It can happen. It's just making sure people are aware of it, I think, is the most important thing. Whether or not what they said was fabricated, it's there. Like,
what's the purpose of it, though? I mean, I could understand people want to know what Trump's doing on his cell phone because he uses an Apple. I just saw that in a recent article. But otherwise,
they said it wasn't worthwhile.
Yeah, but what is?
Well, so remember we've had instances of malware and viruses and stuff that aren't intended to exfiltrate information. They're intended to disrupt certain services. So, what was one of those worms that was designed to get through air gapped systems and actually mess with nuclear power plants?
Stuxnet.
It doesn't have to be the case that the system is trying to send information out, but if it enables another virus or worm or something to get in because you've sort of changed the way that
some part of code
everything is performed on that machine, that there's a hard-coded value in there now or something, then all of those things allow a vector to get access to that machine. It doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be outbound. And there is some weird sort of stuff you can do if you have access to a machine as well. There's a website I think I've talked about before where if you've got an Apple laptop, and some other laptops work as well, you can actually just run a set of commands in your browser. It just does some calculations. Those calculations cause the system bus on the laptop to emit a frequency that can be picked up by FM radio as music.
Wow.
Like, it's... I'll link the... So that sort of stuff, like, that you don't need to use the Ethernet port if you're close enough to the server. Like, you could send stuff out just using this series of electronic emanations. Like, you could be in the next rack over or something, filtering and searching for these specific things. And it sort of reminds me of the old, Tempest Eliza hacks, where they were broadcasting FM radio using a CRT monitor or picking up the keyboard strokes that someone was typing from one room over. Yeah. Like, that sort of stuff can happen.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it seems ridiculous, right? Like logically for muggles, you know, mere mortals like us to think about hacking hardware, you know, because the low hanging fruit is the software, you know, like if you go to Hack 5, they have these little things called something bunnies. I can't remember. It looks like a thumb drive.
Bash bunny.
Yeah. This kid. But it's basically they have
Mr. Robot.
They have a little market. Once you buy one, they're $100. It's got like a quad core CPU built into this thing, and you can just download all the exploits you want onto it. And then it's got several selections on this switch on the side, and you just switch it to whichever exploit you want it to have. You plug it in, and it emulates HID devices of all kinds, keyboards.
I actually have one.
Mice. Oh, God. I want to get Which one, one, actually. I have one in my shopping cart right now. But, it, you know, it'll also emulate network interfaces and stuff like that. And so what do they say? Like pwned in 7 seconds or something like that? Like it will literally compromise the system that fast. You plug it in, it'll compromise, you pull it out. Or you can leave it in and have direct console access into this thing. So,
and it's,
you know, when you...
I think it's important to talk about this stuff. Even if it was a fake article, there is another article that was almost equivalent to this in the programming world that somebody released an article on Twitter, and this guy basically went into detail on how he has a package on this site called NPM. There's a package manager for like JavaScript applications, and he basically said, I'm not going to name the application, but I've had this application on NPM for a few years now, and this whole time I've been collecting all of the credit card informations in your forms on your websites. And he writes this long article explaining how it works, how the malicious code works, and how many websites it's in. And by the end of it, he admits like it was fake. But people didn't read that far. They just read through the beginning part. And everyone just freaked out online. But it's the same thing.
Wasn't there the idea that you start like an open source project and it's something that gets integrated into hundreds of other open source projects, and eventually at some point you roll in some exploit to that, and then it will just get pushed into all these other projects, and it's buried so deep in the code nobody ever really notices it, right?
You mean like OpenSSL?
Shit.
But it's and like the instance of like the Bash Bunny, those little devices, it can basically turn itself into a network adapter, and it can use your internet connection through a proxy. And I did some tests with it, and you can walk up to a Windows machine, plug it in, and rip all the passwords off the machine from, like, RAM. And then it takes, like, not even a second and a half. There's a quick flash. It runs some PowerShell, closes everything out, cleans up after itself. The LED turns green. You pull it out, and you just ripped all the passwords off their machine. And it literally takes a second and a half.
Yeah.
Or it could post off to the internet.
It's just
it's pretty,
like on TV.
So I think it's interesting, though, right? So if you think about software, it's sort of ephemeral, right? It's temporary. So if somebody flashes it, it's gone. You know, if you find a compromised machine, your grandma gives you her laptop and it's just full of trash. What do? You just burn it down and you build new, right? But if you actually have something in the hardware, you know, somebody's going to go to that level. There is no coming back from that, theoretically. You know, there is no flash of new firmware on it or something like that. So it's just sort of interesting to think about. But also in that Serve the Home article, I thought it was interesting. He said the SEC needs to look at everyone who short sold the Supermicro stock or sold off large quantities just before it hit and investigate those people.
That's good. I thought it was very interesting because there's a confirmed hack for Dell's BMC, the iDRAC. It's called iDracula, which was confirmed about 3 or 4 weeks beforehand. It received zero press coverage. I've not seen it mentioned anywhere yet. Supermicro's hack is not confirmed. There's no evidence of it happening, yet it got coverage everywhere. And it's like, this is very odd.
Are you going to say this is fake news? Go ahead, say it. Go ahead, say it.
I wasn't going to say that, too. I'll let you say
it's
that.
It's just hard to tell because you think of all these companies that have contracts with these vendors, and they're not deploying a couple boxes. They've got data centers and compartments full of these servers. So if you think about how much of that infrastructure hosts our cloud services, or if you have droplets on some of the cloud-hosted providers, it's kind of scary to think that your business data could be vulnerable in some regard that way. So I get why it got so much.
Yeah, and obviously the stock price reflected that. You know, they took a
why does any of this matter? The world isn't going to last another 100 years with the global warming and climate change and shit. I mean, fuck it, anarchy. Go ahead.
You know, anarchy is just the concept that doesn't exist. There'd be anarchy for like 5 seconds, and then the strongest person would take control. Yeah. Again, so
wait till you see the next earthquake in California. You want to see anarchy? People looting shit. Why do you think I got guns and ammo up to the teeth for shit like that that happens? Might want to edit
and
that out.
And you're a liberal, right? You're a liberal saying that you're stockpiling weapons. It's such a, an enigma.
Is that your rocket launcher in the background?
Yeah, nobody can understand me. I don't eat mammals. I'm super liberal. I got a shitload of guns and ammo. I drove a giant SUV. And I mean,
so
none of it makes
contributing
any...
to the global warming issue is what you're telling me.
It's not me. It's my wife, actually, because we have a kid.
Blame it on your wife.
If they ever get into an accident, I want the other person to get fucked up because my SUV weighs 6,500 pounds.
He's such a ding dong. All right, so we're actually hitting the hour mark. So I'm gonna do the last one. It's sort of a thought provoker because you know I like to think the thoughts and feel the feels. This one's not a feel the feel, but. There was some spirited discourse in our IPv6 Slack channel, and it was really surrounding somebody who was saying like very inflammatory things on the internet. And so what I think is...
I wasn't in that Slack channel. Where was I? Fine.
I don't know.
I think I might have started that.
Anyway. It got me thinking about it. You know, it's like, you know, why did people put purposely inflammatory things on the internet, right? Obviously, there's something missing inside their brain. Inside of them that they feed off of this stuff. And somebody's like, yeah, dude, they're called trolls. And I was like, yeah, I mean, yeah. But it also made me think, would trolls exist without the internet? So roll back 50 years, right? Where you didn't have any instant contact with media, right? You couldn't post crap on Twitter. You couldn't go on Facebook and, you know, just say the most jacked up thing you can think of. You know, you couldn't go in somebody's YouTube comments and flame them. So what would you do if you were like a quote unquote troll? You couldn't write the newspaper, you know, in the hopes that they would post your inflammatory article, calling somebody a noob or get good or something. You know what I mean? It's like, so did the internet actually birth trolls? I know the internet didn't create assholes. There were plenty of them beforehand.
I think that was the premise of when the internet started. I mean, a lot of it was researchers from universities riffing on each other for theories they were posting. I mean, as soon as you have an opportunity to say things to somebody and not to their face, because, I mean, most human beings have empathy and some level of respect for other people, so you can't just walk up to someone and say those kind of things to their face, but you have a screen in between you, and you get to just throw stuff out there and not worry about it, really.
For sure.
So,
is that what they call keyboard heroes or something like that? What do they call them?
Keyboard warrior, probably.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's very true, you know, and I don't want to get political or anything, but I think people do that with, you know, they can say, we don't want immigrants, you know, we don't want refugees, because they make this whole group of people that desperately need help, they make them a word, they're not humans anymore. They're just this word, right? So they can like sort of disassociate themselves from the humanity there, you know?
I'm going to be nice. I'm going to be nice.
So I think it's, I think you're definitely onto something. I was just curious, you know, would it be somebody who would like write graffiti on a wall? Was that a pre-internet troll?
Prank calling.
Is
your refrigerator running?
Yeah.
You remember the movie Turk 182? I think that was the original form of troll, sort of.
How come you guys don't watch movies? Nick never saw The Fifth Element. Fucking Greg, you never saw What About Bob?
I've seen it. It was just a million years ago, dude.
Okay, well, now you got to watch Turk 182. Boom.
Why do we need to watch Turk 182?
Because it's all about the original troll. Well, maybe not
the bridge kind, or
yeah, the Alchemist. Yeah, no, it's the riddles.
I mean, troll is an internet term. I think before the word really, what trolling is just instigating, right? Isn't that what it's all about? Just being an instigator, an enabler, an asshole of sorts.
And see the specific person that it got brought up about. Of course, it's about IPv6, and it's something that. Other than, you know, BGP and RouterOS version 7, there's always the people with IPv6 just because of how much bigger the IP space is. And as soon as people talk about that, they bring up, like, Internet of Things devices and how it's going to take down networks and, like, shouldn't be running IPv6. And it's like, it was half troll, but it knew it was going to spark a conversation. You have the people that are going to try to give good resources about IPv6 to educate people. Not listen to the poster, and then it was just nonstop back and forth of them saying.
I think that's the wrong way to approach it, right? Yeah, it's going to spark conversation, but it's so inflammatory that people like me, I'm going to instantly turn off. I'm not even going to read any more of it, you know. And so, people that could, I mean, I still have a lot to learn about everything. I'm never going to claim to be an expert, and so I'm sure reading through that, I probably could have learned a lot, but I'm not going to do it because somebody was being a dick. And it's like, I don't have time for that. You know what I mean?
See, those conversations bring generally two types of people. The people that are totally agree with the poster on how IPv6 with Internet of Things devices is the end of networks. And then you have the people that actually understand IPv6 and implementation that are trying to help people. So it's just these people that don't want to listen to how it actually works. And they have their preconceived ideas of their network vulnerabilities, and it's just nobody's getting anywhere, and so I just gave up. But then I posted it in the Slack because I thought other people might enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just think when there's blood in the water, it tends to attract sharks. You know what I mean? And those, it's usually like really dominant alpha people that want their opinion, you know, bam, just forced, and there's no flex. Like I tell my kids all the time, you know, when you say stuff, leave a little wiggle room in there just in case, you know, you don't actually know what you're talking about. I have this 12-year-old and he's got this I call it a problem. He's got this attribute where he says everything so confidently that you usually think he thinks, you know, it's like yeah, and then he'll say something very confidently about something you know about, and you know he's wrong. He's like, dude, that's not right. It's like, you got to leave some wiggle room, because one day you're going to do that in front of somebody, the wrong person who really knows their shit on this, and they're going to make you look like a fool in front of a bunch of people. Yeah, dude. Because I say that because I've been slapped across the face with that before, and I was like, oh, I'm never doing that again. Yeah, you got to leave a little wiggle room. So these people, they leave no wiggle room, you know? They don't invite the opportunity to have their opinion changed at all. So, you know, all you can do is just argue, you know, it's just shouting your beliefs, you know. It's like, I love chocolate. It's like, yeah, okay, great, dude. I, you know, I'm allergic to it.
Can't eat only chocolate.
Yeah, that, you know,
pretty much sums up my approach to public speaking. It's like, I've got to present something, I have to go over it like 15 times to make sure everything I'm saying is correct. And then I always start the thing with, like, if something in here is wrong, feel free to tell me, because I don't want to be...
That's exactly how I feel before giving microtech speeches, because you know there's people in the crowd that are just,
you know,
waiting
more than you, like...
with their finger on the trigger, waiting for you to say something that means 100% accurate.
At all the moms I've ever been to, I've only seen a very small handful of times somebody be a dick to a presenter. So it's very rare. So
just waiting for that guy at the back to put his hand up and be like, I just wanted to say you're wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it's okay. Interesting too, because I follow the YouTube page with Microtech. So when they do release all the videos, I get a notification and I try to watch most of them. And I found it interesting that most of the like Asian area countries, they have like super technical complex talks there. And there's a lot of good information. And then I watched like the US ones and everyone's like too scared to go too in depth, because I actually saw one where this guy's talk, I can't remember where it was, but I think it was on BGP, like a failover with like VRRP. He was doing the talk there and he actually had hardware there and he had the dude set up so you could kind of see the failover happen. And this guy just kept interrupting him the whole time. He kept throwing him off like every 5 minutes. He was trying to argue with him. And it's just, that's one of the reasons I've never even thought about talking. It's or just,
dude,
just
you should rude. Because if anybody like that,
no one can argue with
but what's funny is if some, you know, there's probably 50 great presentations, you know, that went smooth and everybody was very cordial, but it's that one that sticks out in your mind, right? You know, it's like I don't remember all of my successes, but I remember most of my failures. So that's just human nature though.
But there are ways to try and recover from that. I mean, if a guy is going to keep cutting you off, I mean, you just got to tell him, look, you're being unfair to the rest of the audience. I'm trying to have trying to give a talk here. You know, if you want, we could talk afterwards and just make him look like an asshole. And you could do that very cordially. But, you know, I wouldn't know anything else to do. Otherwise, kick him in the fucking throat. Now you can't talk.
Actually, I don't think they'd let you talk.
You are the strangest liberal I have ever met, dude.
I actually had to do that in one of my mum presentations in Sydney, I think. Really? I gave. There was a guy who was constantly interrupting. I said, hey, mate, I'm happy to ask you questions, but just if you don't mind asking me later because you're holding up the progress of the presentation. Perfect. He shut up.
That reminds me of I was at this Lunch and Learn, and the guy was going to talk for 45 seconds. He was one of the co-sponsors. And as soon as he said, hey, my name is blah, 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 and like, I don't know, probably 20 seconds into that, some guy's phone rings and he answers it and he starts talking. The guy seamlessly goes, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your call. Everybody be quiet. And just sits there. As soon as the guy tangs up his phone, he just picks up and keeps rolling. I was like, you, sir, our boss. Yeah, it was pretty baller. That was a sweet move. But I think what Thrift said is 100% correct, you know, because I think some people don't necessarily have the same toolbox everybody else does, right? So they don't understand social cues and, you know, when to interject and when not to. So I think some people, if you honestly say, hey, exactly what Andrew did, they'll be like, oh, I'm sorry. And, you know, kind of reel it back a little bit.
Just put them on the spot a little bit. Nobody wants that negative attention, especially in a room full of people. I do like the kick in the throat technique, though. You probably wouldn't give another speech again.
Would you be able to get your foot that high, Dave? I mean, it's pretty
well. If it's you, if it's you, probably not. But if it's
I think even if
somewhere
I'm sitting, Dave, I'm sure you could get it up there.
Probably. Uh-huh. I'd go for the chop to the neck with you. Chop, chop.
Judo chop, like Austin Powers. All right, so I say we stick a fork in it. You guys have anything else that's just burning a hole in your pocket that you need to get out? No? All right, so Dave from LA, who does the penny tone thing, which is a VoIP thing. If people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
Let's think. Well, probably email is the best way. I've gotten some pretty awesome emails from a couple of people watching. Just funny emails, nothing too serious or serious at all. But you can email me, drop me a line, say, hey, what's up, asshole? What is this whole awards thing about? but I'll be glad to show you pictures.
His award thing is more, it's more an experience than anything else, though.
Yeah, totally. Actually, real quick, somebody at Wispapalooza, these awards are getting so popular that... what's his name? Tassos from RF Elements.
Somebody slipped an award in his backpack, and he immediately went on Facebook and said, "Thank you, Dave, for sending me an award." And I was like, "I wish I could take credit for this, but I honestly didn't give you one." And I'm like, "Send me a picture."
It also seems like so he would have a blast with that. You get a good laugh at that.
He thought it was funny. But anyway, to get in touch with me, it's david@pennytone.com.
All right. And Mr. Cox, all the way from Australia, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would they do that?
Best way is admin@microtik-radios.com. That's the unofficial site. one day they're probably going to want that domain.
And you're going to get $20 out of it. It's going to be sweet. But that's also Andrew's blog, so you can pop in there for some of his cool stuff. Andrew Cox's blog, I'm sorry. Now, Andrew Thrift, the Kiwi hiding out in Australia, if people don't know you that well, you're a very talented, brilliant consultant. You do a lot of work with pretty much the biggest routers that I will never touch. So if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
You can find me on Twitter @pushpopswap, or you can email me andrew@networklabs.co.nz.
NZ. NZ.
Could you say that? Could you say that again? Push pop squad? What the
you
hell was
push,
that?
So pop, excited when you
said that. Push pop swap.
Swab?
Push pop
swap. All right. Is that like an Australian term or something?
No, dude. It's a networking thing.
Mind Kelly.
Push pop swap. Okay.
Yeah, like labels. You push
never
and
heard
pop. Or...
And what's the last one?
That's where you trade baseball cards with your friends.
Yeah.
Swap.
Oh,
wives. See? That's a task for you, Dave. You can Google that later, and you can look up where Australia is.
Why, he's not from Australia, is he? I thought you are.
I am.
Oh, okay. No, so what the hell?
He's living in Australia. He's from...
I live in Australia now, but I'm from New Zealand.
That's what threw me off about the accent. Anyway.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's what...
Well, it's a little different. It is a little different.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. He doesn't
lick the sack.
He doesn't like run around chasing thieves with his flip flops and stuff like that. Like a normal Australian.
We call them thongs.
Right. I thought they were. I thought you called them pluggers.
You wear a pair of them.
Yeah.
Oh man, flip flops.
Yeah, there you go. Nick, you're doing some consulting and various things of the such. It sounds like you've been doing a lot more server stuff than anything else lately. But if people want to get a hold of you on the internet, if you want them to, how would they go about doing that?
You can email me at nick@arellano.io, which is ArellaNO. And also, if you're not in the Patreon group, the Slack channel is awesome. I try to reply as much as I can for anything that I can help people with, but there's a lot of smarter people than me in there.
Well, I think to your point there, actually spell your name one more time because it took me 3 attempts.
It's Arellano.
All right. Arellano. So, to your point, it doesn't matter how much you do or don't know. Everybody's got an experience of one kind or another. So, sharing your experiences, I think, is invaluable for everyone, you know. Your take on it might be different than somebody like, so somebody that's been doing something for say 10 years, your vision of how it works or how it should work, can be very invaluable. I learned stuff about the way I'm doing things from you guys all the time, because I've just always done it this way and it's worked successfully for me, but I didn't know there was a better way. Right. So, you know, we have, what do you call it? The burden of knowledge. So whenever you're trying to explain something to people, you have this assumption of knowledge from them, right? That you assume they know all these points. And so it can be very eye-opening, you know, when you actually have to work out every step in the process. You guys write a lot of documentation and forget to add basic things because you just assume they know how to do that stuff. Mm. Yeah. It happens a lot. So it's great. It's a great mix of people. So since you mentioned it, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp is the patron again. You get on there and then you get access to the Slack group. We've got a bunch of channels in there now. So if you are in the Slack group and you're listening to this, go to the channels, click the channels thing and make sure you're subscribed to everything. Just turn off notifications. I turn off notifications for everything except for like at or direct messages. That way it's not constantly binging. But that way, you know, you don't feel guilty about having all of these extra channels in there because there's interesting stuff. And we've gotten much better about staying on topic in those channels. It gets a little sideways when Dave gets in there. But for the most part, we're pretty good about
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you. If you want to get a hold of me, it's greg@gregsoul.com. That's S-O-W-E-L-L, like so well. Mine's easy. Sorry, Nick. I
don't think it's that difficult, but then again, I've had that name my whole life.
You've been spelling it a long time, brother. See, you have the burden of knowledge. Exactly what I was talking about, dude.
Yep.
Burden of knowledge right there. My blog, gregsoul.com, occasionally do some things here and there. Hit us up if you have any questions or comments or any ideas for the show, anything like that. The Slack's a great place because it's interactive. Also, contact us at thebrotherswisp.com and then facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. Mike usually puts lots of stuff up there, but after Wispapalooza, he's been broken for a minute. So he hasn't put a lot of stuff up there. I guess thanks everyone for listening. Thank you guys for joining. I love having this variety of people. It makes it so much more interesting. I know everyone gets sick of listening to me. So questions, comments, keep them coming, and thank you guys for joining. And thank all the patrons, thank all the people. We talk about equipment and methodology,
so sit back and start learning. Lighting up the tower so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, cause fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.